Hello and welcome to Everyday Sublime. This is your host, Josh Summers. I hope you're having a good day, and I invite you to settle in, whether you're walking, driving, or maybe hanging out in some yin yoga poses. I invite you to settle in, and I hope you enjoy today's reflections, where I offer some thoughts around how to creatively work with not just one mantra, but a few different kinds of cultivated mantras when you practice, or if you practice, with a beaded garland. And if you're interested in this practice, I've been offering a kind of loose series of reflections around working with beaded mala beads or rosary beads or garland by any other name. I highly recommend this practice. It complements a lot of the other practices that we explore on the Everyday Sublime. And before I give you the episode, today's talk, I just want to give a shout out to the Sangha, the Riverbird Sangha, where I came up with the kind of catchphrase where lives begin to flow and hearts take flight. This is the idea of a riverbird, that we tune into the river of our life through embodiment practices such as yin yoga, qigong, yang yoga. We cultivate a spirit of heart intelligence with contemplative methodologies, contemplative practices such as meditation and insight meditation and bead practice. And all the members of this Sangha, this group, we meet online 4 times a week. Our classes that Terry and I teach are available as recordings and are archived in our library, which also includes tutorials for beginners. And I should also add that we just refreshed our website. So we're very pleased with the organization now. We're hoping that the organization of our site offers a more user-friendly interface for students and members of our group. So check it out. There's a link for you in the show notes. We are going to be offering a free mini course soon as part of what you get when you register or sign up for our newsletter. That's going to be a series called Everyday Vitality, and I expect that to be available in 2 weeks. That will be 4 of our favorite practices for strengthening and circulating energy, or qi. But in the meantime, we're still offering our free book, The What, Why, and How of Yin Yoga. When you sign up for our newsletter, you also get 2-week free trial. You get a free week, 2 free week trial in our membership to practice along with us and see if we're the right fit for you. And we invite you to practice with us. Again, we're the online yin-based community where lives begin to flow and hearts take flight. Just going to keep plugging that little tagline and see how it plays with you guys. Anyway, here's today's talk, The Heart's Precept. Let me know what you think. Shoot me an email at josh@joshsummers.net. Stay tuned for more conversations. Terry and I are going to be recording a chi chat later this afternoon, and I believe we're going to discuss sort of my theories about how yin yoga helps cultivate qi, how yin yoga strengthens and circulates our energy. And I'll be sharing part of my critique of why I don't think yin yoga stimulates channels the way that it is described quite frequently in the yin yoga community. I'm sort of taking a somewhat provocative position here, and I'm just trying to help the yin yoga culture expand and grow a broader, more inclusive model about how this beautiful practice of floor-based poses called yin yoga, how this beautiful contemplative practice is really integrates and collaborates with the essential functions of the organs as described in Chinese medicine. So stay tuned for that. I've gotten a lot of good feedback and responses to my recent interview that I published with the Insight meditation teacher and resident teacher at the Insight Meditation Society, Chaz de Capua. So that episode is just before this one in the feed. Check that out. Thanks for your listenership. Thanks for your support. And I hope you enjoy today's episode, The Heart's Precept. So in the, just with awareness of all that is going on, I wanted to continue this morning just to offer a a few hopefully short reflections around working with our meditation practice, specifically working with intentions or intentions that are encapsulated or embodied in a phrase like a mantra, and how the combination of mantra and a garland of beads or, you know, counting using your fingers can be a way of planting very, very important seeds in your own heart, and how that can support a sense of integration and development on your own path in this Dharma journey or journey into the heart. And to sort of introduce what I want to open up today, at the end of last week, you may know I published an interview that I had recorded last fall. And as I said in the introduction to that podcast, I've been sitting on about 5 or 6 interviews that I did last fall. And for one reason or another, I just haven't published them yet. But last fall, I did a whole series of interviews with teachers from the Insight Meditation Society in Barre, Massachusetts, that I've had direct contact with that have been deeply influential on my own practice. And those include the podcast that I published, which was with Chaz de Capua. And Chaz is the resident teacher at the Insight Meditation Society. He's the teacher for all the staff at that institution. And he's been there for over 20 years. I've known him essentially since he took over that position. I met him first as someone who was available to me as a work retreatant. I was doing work retreats as a way to attend retreats, and meaning I'd do 4 hours of work when I was on retreat as an exchange for a free access to the retreat. And I would meet with him to talk about how my practice was going. And then a few years later, I invited Chaz and a few other teachers to the yoga studio I was at in Boston. And I think some of you even met Chaz there, where he would come in for day-long retreats. And just a teacher that I've always appreciated. But he was also a teacher to my late friend, Michael Brooks. And some of you have heard me speak about Michael in the past. Michael passed away, I think, about 4 years ago now. And Michael was, when he died early at 37, he was really coming into his full, his prime, as a lot of people said. He was coming into his prime as a kind of political pundit of sorts. He was a kind of a prophet of the left. He was speaking to societal issues around inequity, racism, and injecting the conversation on the left with the importance of spirituality, the importance of interior cultivation, because some of you may be aware, but in strong left circles, particularly strong left materialistic circles, any notion of spirituality or religion is sort of summed up by Marx's famous phrase that religion is just the opiate of the masses. It's an agent of suppression and oppression, and is therefore very problematic. But Michael is taking a different line on that. And in the conversation I had with Chaz from Insight Meditation, who was one of Michael's teachers, I brought up something that I remember Michael having a real difficult time with in Buddhism. And this is the introduction to the theme I want to explore today. And Michael's issue with Buddhism was that Michael had a lot of ambition. Michael's soul, Michael's spirit had a tremendous amount of ambition in life. When I met him, he was 18 years old. I was 28 at the time, so there's a 10-year gap between us. And where I was sort of at that point in my life, just becoming a professionalized adult at 28, Michael was just entering university and thinking about what he wanted to do, what he wanted to become. And when I asked him at 18, I said, "Do you have any idea what you want to do with your life?" And he, you know, deadpan, and he's a very funny guy. I mean, he was known as a kind of a comic genius, but there was no comedy here, and just a deadpan face. He said, "Yeah, I'd probably like to be the president or a senator." And, you know, I never met anybody at that age who had that kind of ambition. But I knew from my friendship with Michael that his ambition, he felt that in conflict with his ambition within his own spiritual practice, that within the Buddhist culture that he and I were effectively being brought up in at IMS, within the Buddhist culture, there was almost it was a pathology to have too much desire. The desire itself was pathologized. That, you know, if you look at Buddhism, the source of our suffering is personal or selfish desires, grasping at things, and that the path of peace is one of learning to recognize and then let go of desires and sort of eradicate desires from your heart and become free of desires. And that desireless state is meant to open us into a deeper sense of fulfillment, a deeper sense of peace, a deeper sense of equanimity that transcends everything and makes it all worth it. And Michael and I, you know, and other people, I think, were always wrestling with that, you know, noticing that we had real world desires. We had ambition for the kind of life we wanted, the kind of relationships we wanted, the kind of employment and livelihood we wanted. And that felt discordant, that felt at odds with the heart of the Dharma that we were receiving. And that tension that I'm describing could be crystallized in a particular exchange between Michael and his teacher, and this teacher that I interviewed, Chaz, where Michael came to me once and he said, "Yeah, I was just talking to Chaz about my ambition to go to New York and to get into, you know, podcasting and more various kinds of digital media on the political landscape." And Chaz said to me, he said, "You know, no matter what, I would always be content just to work at Whole Foods bagging groceries and sending metta to every customer that came through the aisle." Which in itself, you know, is, I think, a lovely idea. I mean, no matter what we do, there's always a way to find, I think, a way to integrate our heart's desire or our heart's dharma in the activity. So if circumstances were such that I was bagging groceries at Whole Foods or at Trader Joe's or at Hannaford nearby, I would hope that I would have the presence of mind to see the opportunity to send kindness, to send compassion to every sentient being that I met in the checkout line. But for Michael, what Michael was frustrated by was that way of expressing it was sort of seen as an ideal, and that if you were unsatisfied with that, that was a symptom of kind of an egoic striving or a symptom of an egoic desire, and that the ego wasn't allowing you to see the dharmic opportunity in all conditions. And I remember very specifically, like, one day Michael was at visiting my house, my apartment in Arlington, and we were sitting on my porch on a spring afternoon, and he was just complaining about Chaz, saying, "I can't believe Chaz wants me to send metta to people in the checkout line. Like, doesn't he realize, like, I want to be a senator, I want to be president, I have all these ambitions." And so that came up, and that's, you'll hear that in the podcast if you listen to it. But where I want to go with this is that I sent the episode after I published it. I sent it as a text message to Michael's mother, who I'm in touch with still. And I just said, I just want you to know that Chaz and I were talking, reminiscing about Michael some. You might like to listen to this episode. And about an hour after I sent it to her, I was actually practicing my saxophone at the time, and my phone rang, and it was Donna, Michael's mother, was calling. So I picked up the phone, which I feel like I rarely do these days, not rarely answer the phone anymore, but I answered the call. And she really appreciated that I captured Michael's frustration with parts of the culture at IMS, namely this conflicted relationship to desire, or this conflicted relationship to ambition. And she said, I wasn't aware of this myself, but she said that towards the end of Michael's life, he was looking into Hinduism and he was looking into Judaism for ways to better find a spiritual outlet for his ambition, to find a spiritual environment where ambition was not pathologized, where ambition was seen as part of the path and integrated into that in a more perhaps fuller or complete expression of what it means to be a human. And I, as she said that, I thought, that's really interesting to me. And feels almost synchronistic, because as I shared with Donna, I said, recently I've been getting into bead-based practices, which I've been sharing with all of you here. And one of the root messages I'm receiving from the world of bead-based meditation is that, A, it is, at its essence, the bead-based practice has emerged out of a very, very, very old human spirituality, just found cross-culturally, across epochs of time, but has evolved out of a form of goddess worship. It's explicitly a practice that honors and recognizes and aligns with the divine feminine, which... as I thought about that more, I just wanted to mention that on one level, Taoism is probably the only world religion or major world religion that is explicitly aligned with the feminine, with the mother of all things. Tao is being defined as the mother of all things. So this goddess worship is could be described as honoring the creative nature of the world. It could be seen as honoring the earth itself as the very soil of creativity from which all life emerges. And the second part of honoring the goddess, honoring the feminine, the divine feminine, honoring the mother of creativity in our life, is that the practice is centered around devoting one's life energy to realizing one's heart's desire. One's heart's desire. Another word for that could be spiritual ambition. And as I've been reflecting on what heart's desire could mean, I don't claim to say I know exactly what it means, but I'm questioning that in my own practice. I'm feeling the contrast between holding that question, what is my heart's desire? What do I want most in my life? What do I value most? As I hold that question, I'm becoming increasingly aware of the contrast between that orientation and, say, a more Buddhist-based orientation that is trying to eradicate desire as the root of my problems. Buddhism, you very rarely see in any kind of Buddhism an emphasis on your heart's desire. It's often expressed as, you know, as I've been saying, seeing and getting rid of desires. So what I'm trying to offer here as a reflection is, it's not that we necessarily have to get rid of the teaching or the edifice of dharmic wisdom that we've received, whether it's the teachings of the Four Noble Truths or the divine abodes, the great qualities of the heart like metta and karuna, kindness and compassion. But if we are interested in sort of expanding or being a little bit more inclusive of within our path around, instead of getting rid of desires, but platforming, to use a contemporary word, if we were to platform at the center of our practice our own heart's desire, and then engage with our practices in alignment with that energy, I think that can be an interesting way of exploring this path. And so last week, or for the last couple of weeks, I have mentioned that we're exploring the theme of the precepts, or exploring the theme of ethical guidelines, ethical orientation to life. And different spiritual traditions will articulate these ethical standards, ethical injunctions, ethical norms differently. But in Buddhism, they're referred to as the precepts, the five training precepts. And as I said last week, they tend to be expressed as do's and don'ts. Don't kill, don't steal, don't cheat, don't lie, don't intoxicate, essentially. And then cultivate the opposite, nourish life or support life, be generous, be straightforward with in your relationships, don't lie, tell the truth, be honest, and don't consume. Don't consume intoxicants that cloud the mind. It's a sort of a simple black and white binary of do's and don'ts. And as I shared last week, that orientation of do's and don'ts and kind of taking a regular inventory of how am I doing with the precepts? Well, I broke that one there, and when I slaughtered a mosquito, I broke that one. And, you know, when I took a pencil out of Terry's pencil box without asking her, I was stealing a pencil, I broke that precept. You know, there's often a sense of you take an inventory like a spiritual accountant, and you realize you're coming up short. At least that's the way I felt a lot. And so rather than approach that list as a mental exercise of inventory taking, the way I've been working with it personally this week, and this is just what I wanted to share from my own practice, is it occurred to me, what does it mean? What would it be like to bring the precepts into conversation with one's heart's desire? What if those two spiritual dimensions were brought into conversation with each other? And I'm not assuming any of us know or could even articulate right now what our heart's desire is. So if you're thinking to yourself, I don't even know what my heart's desire is, that's fine. I think the heart's desire is something that will grow and reveal itself more and more over time as we just create space within our practice and within our contemplative life to be available to it. So every time I say those words, heart's desire, and you come up blank and maybe draw a little face of confusion, you're not alone. But I even think that bringing in a question of the precepts within the heart's desire might help open up and help your own heart listen into your heart's desire better. So what I mean by this is, if the precepts are about not killing, not stealing, not cheating, not lying, and not consuming bad things, if that's the essence of the precepts, one of the ways I've been contemplating it is to ask, well, what is killing? What kind of energy, what kinds of activities, what kinds of things are killing my heart's desire? Are killing the energy of my heart's desire? And suddenly that becomes much less a question about what kind of diet I'm following, or what is my relationship to the earth in terms of my relationship to trees and plants, or how am I handling a mosquito in the house problem? It's much less about following a sort of a conventional list of do's and don'ts, and it becomes a contemplative question for me to look closely and comprehensively into my life around how I'm investing my energy. What kind of activities, what kinds of behaviors, what kinds of time sinks are literally killing the life force of my heart's desire? Or, you know, then you can go right down all the whole list. What is stealing from my heart's desire? What is cheating my heart's desire? What is lying about my heart's desire? Or what is consuming my heart's desire? And it just as you can go through the precepts with that more typical traditional frame of the negative, like don't kill, don't steal, don't cheat, don't lie, don't consume bad things. It could be framed positive. You can see the flip side of it, the other side of the coin. What's nourishing? What in my life is nourishing my heart's desire? What is giving, instead of stealing, what is giving to my heart's desire right now? Or what is collaborating and consenting wisely and compassionately instead of cheating? What is wisely collaborating, consenting to my heart's desire in my life? What is speaking truth about my heart's desire? And what is, instead of consuming my heart's desire, what is helping generate? You know, the opposite of consumption would be generation. What is generating my heart's desire? And when I've asked these questions, it's not that I necessarily have a particular answer that's coming to mind right away. It's not necessarily that a clear answer comes over the week. What I'm noticing primarily is that the reflection itself seems to channel my energy, what we call chi in the Sangha, you know, the life force. It seems to channel my energy to be engaged creatively in a different way. And to my heart, that feels better. It feels like it's a better way. I feel more engaged. I feel more juice, or my I think I told you I tutor a high school or a middle school student and in writing, and he uses the word spunk when there's a lot of good energy in writing. And so, you know, asking these questions feels like it brings a kind of spunk, good energy, a more lively engagement with all of the conditions of life. So I just want to offer that today, you know, that we're exploring what does it mean, you know, we're exploring the theme of ethics in our life, personal ethics. And rather than framing them as do's and don'ts, to-do lists, rather than framing them as these lists of black and white things to do and don't do, I'm trying to present them as a way that we can frame them as contemplative questions. And if we bring those contemplative questions into the question of our heart's desire, I hope you might feel and see that they all, like, what is killing my heart's desire? What's stealing my heart's desire? What's cheating my heart's desire? What's lying about? They're all sides of the same thing. They're all sides of the same question. And in contemplating them this way, you might find that your own energy gets clarified. Your own energy gets a little more prioritized. And you might start making decisions like, oh, my heart's desire is to write a short story this month, as an example, or my heart's desire is to find my soulmate soon. You might spend your energy differently at night. You might not get onto Netflix. You might do something else. You might write another hour in your notebook, or you might go join whatever people do now to meet new people in their life if they're looking for a partner. But your energy will be channeled in a different way than if maybe you hadn't considered this. Now, the way I have been exploring this with the beads, and I just want to spend a couple of minutes offering this idea. The way I've been exploring working with the precepts and the beads is to, last week we talked about generating a mantra, personalized mantra. And I want to continue to recommend this, that either you draw from one of the world's traditions' great mantras, which could be found in Buddhism and yoga and Hinduism and Christianity, any of the great religions or wisdom traditions from anywhere in the world. I want you to feel complete freedom to find the language of a more traditional mantra if you're interested in that. As I've been reflecting on the function of a mantra, I feel like the general mantra's idea is that it is sort of a working mission statement of the heart. It's sort of an encapsulation or an essentialization of a mission statement for the heart. You know, whether it's, may I support the freedom and peace of all beings, may I have compassion for all beings, may I live in a way that's attuned to my deepest desires. It's sort of a mission statement for the heart. And as I was saying earlier, with the evolution of the bead practice itself coming out of a feminine goddess-based worship, that core mantra can also be, and I'm sort of recommending this, can be an acknowledgement of this divine creative energy that we can attune to, that we can align around, or if you're more devotionally inspired, that we can appeal to. May this divine feminine, may this divine goddess presence of the universe support me in cultivating compassion, in developing wisdom, in realizing my heart's desire. So what I'm recommending is that if you are you working with mantra, to continue to work around drafting or using a more established mantra already, but work with a basic mantra that articulates this core mission. And I know many of you have worked with other traditions that have mantras that you've been sharing with me that you already enjoy. So use that. But every now and then, what I want to suggest is that maybe every 5 beads, every 10 beads, you don't have to worry about counting, but just after a series of repetitions of your core mantra, pause and do this intuitively, but pause and drop in a question around your heart's desire, such as, what is nourishing my heart's desire? What is generously supporting my heart's desire? Or what is killing my heart's desire? You can frame it positively or negatively, but work with the frame a question around the precepts in relationship to your very deepest heart's desire, your heart's desire here. And what I'm trying to propose is that specific contemplative question becomes an invitation into a mystery within your own life. And the mystery isn't necessarily, you know, something shrouded in the mists here or in a cave. It's a mystery about that opens your own heart and mind and unconscious to what would this mean? What does it mean? What needs to change? What needs to evolve? What needs to be creatively solved in my life to bring forth the thing I value the most? And I hope you hear that this is going to be a very personal affair. I'm not at all trying to plug in any kind of dogma or orthodoxy here. But I'm trying to just open some suggestions for how you as an individual can interface the gardening of a practice with beads the use of the main mantra is going to till the soil, prepare the soil, and then when you drop in the question, what is nourishing my heart's desire? What is consuming my heart's desire? And you could, in that period of contemplative question, you could just quietly recite down the precepts. Go through all five. What is killing my heart's desire? What is stealing my heart's desire? What is cheating my heart's desire? What is lying about my heart's desire? What is consuming my heart's desire? Ask the question sincerely and then just get quiet for a little bit and listen. You're inviting a dialogue with your own complete consciousness, and your consciousness is relationship to the divine, listening for what comes to you. And then as you could listen for, you know, for as long as you'd like, but maybe it might be half a minute to 5 minutes in quietude. And then you might pick up again with your core mantra. May I have compassion for all beings. And just do several beads with your core mantra. Again, tilling the soil until it feels like a right time to take a break from the core mantra, pause with the beads, and ask the question in relationship again to the precepts and your heart's desire. So I'm trying to get at is there's a rhythm here. There's a pulse, there's a rhythmic patterning. There's several beads use of your core mantra. That sort of establishes the rhythm. Then when you feel it's right to take a pause and open and explore within the quietude of your own heart, to explore a question, what is stealing in relationship to my heart's desire? You can go through the precepts and just hold those contemplative questions for a moment, a few minutes. And I'm really asking you and inviting you to trust your intuition on this. Because as I've been working, and again, I'm trying to narrate directly from my own practice, as I've been working with the beads, you know, I'm noticing how powerfully the beads get my own body, mind, and heart to quiet down. I just through the repetition, the holding the beads, that I can feel my mind, like almost like with a scuba tank on, sinking into deeper levels of quiet, going below the surface of the river of my mind, down into the deeper, quieter depths. And when I get down there, that's when I pause and open up with a question. And So just like when you play your edge in a yin pose, I'm hoping that when you work with this practice, you'll start to feel where are you within your own experience? What layer of your own depth of being are you settling into or not? And when is it time to ask a question? When is it time to repeat a mantra? And in this way, I'm hoping that I can share a creative, the two words we define our pedagogy by, a creative functional approach. To know your intention, that's the functional approach, and then have creative ways of playing with it. Okay, everyone, thanks so much for your listenership today. I hope you enjoyed the reflections around working with mantras and bead-based practices. It's certainly been a hugely impactful practice for me right now and for Terry right now in this phase of our life, particularly with the world and life conditions as they are. It's really helpful to hold something in your hands and have that thing that you hold embody your deepest intentions and aspirations. So I hope your practice is serving you. And if you would like support in your practice, if you'd like to be part of our conversation and dialogue with me and Terry regularly on a weekly basis in our live classes, or participate in our classes through recordings in our library, all of that can be available. We give you 2 weeks for free, and then at a sliding fee for monthly memberships, we welcome you into our practice sangha. We look forward to practicing with you. If you have any questions, shoot us an email, josh@joshsummers.net. But otherwise, have a wonderful day. Keep practicing, stay safe, stay strong, and I'll see you in the next episode soon. All my best.